going forever. Moments go, time runs out, and then it hits you with pain. Things are great on the way out, but nobody's with you when you're on the way down. You got what you wish for. Is that what you You're listening to the Gods to Ghosts Volleyball Podcast and your host, Scott Bemke. Our podcast today features part one of our several-part interview with the one and only Butch May. Over his volleyball career, Butch competed at the highest level, both indoors as well as on the beach. Indoors, he competed for the Colonel, Coach Bert DeGroot, in 63 and 64 at Santa Monica Community College, alongside teammates such as Ernie Suora. Butch then went on to earn a spot on the 1968 USA Men's Indoor Olympic team that competed in Mexico City, Mexico. When it comes to his beach career, Butch was a force to be reckoned with on the men's open side, where he won two opens during his career and is widely regarded to be the greatest men's mixed open player to ever play the game, with 20-plus open wins on the mixed side alongside partners such as Eileen Clancy and his late lovely wife, Barbara. Without further ado, let's get going with Butch Part 1.
All right, Butch May. Tell us a bit about your background and where you came from, where you grew up. I heard you had a pretty interesting background before you got involved with volleyball, as far as lumberjack, rodeo rider, and who the hell knows what else. So let's hear it straight from the horse's mouth, no pun intended.
Straight from the horse's mouth. Okay. Scott, I think you're too kind.
Yeah, I do my best, you know. I had to bite my tongue there, Butch.
I was raised in Hawaii. I was born and raised in Hawaii. I was born a month before the war, November 7th, 1941. And I got the nickname Butch from a sailor who was getting off HRT on a little rapid transit at that time. Mm-hmm. And he was a 19-year-old sailor, and he saw that my mom was pregnant. And he reached out in a kind gesture and just touched his stomach and said, "This is going to be a Butch." And my mom corresponded with him right up until the time the Battle of Midway. He was killed a few months later after I was born, the Battle of Midway.
Wow.
I was only 19 years old, and even though I was born Robert May, Robert Stanley May, I was named after my dad. I was a junior. Bush was something that I was going to hang on to, even up to now. So that's how I got the name Bush.
And it stuck.
And, well, my mom made sure, because it was a way of honoring somebody 19 years old. It was in Hawaii, just prior to the Japanese bombing Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But he was in the Navy getting ready to deploy somewhere. Nobody knew where. But my mom got a letter from, I guess, his parents saying that he was killed in the Battle of Midway.
Wow. Yeah, that being Memorial Day yesterday, that kind of stuff resonates a little bit more. Considering, so that's a neat story, buddy.
Well, you know, somebody asked me today at the beach, "What'd you do on Memorial Day?" I said, "What I normally do, I kind of hang around, you know, working up an appetite, not working out, just working up an appetite." And I said, "I kind of said a prayer for all the service people, men and women, who had gone before." Yep. And, you know, I thank them for their service. I thank them openly when I do see them. My daughter does that. My daughter and her husband will, if if they see people in uniform in a restaurant or a fast food restaurant and they're having breakfast, they normally pick up the tab, you know, which I think is a good gesture. Anyway, they said, oh, were you in the service? I said, I was not that lucky to get in the service. And they said, what do you mean you weren't that lucky? I said, well, when I was drafted, I went down Broadway in L.A., and at that time, I didn't know I had a packet following me around. The packet is, these are notices or information that process through the government of your injuries or your background. And at 6:45 that morning, I was called to follow an orange line to go upstairs because Major DeFazio wanted to say something to me. So I took my packet up, and that was after I passed my physical. Anyway, I went upstairs, and if you could see the old movies where you only saw his mouth, his face was hidden, his face and eyes were hidden in the shadow. And he had a light on his mouth, and he said, Robert, this tells me one of three things. And I said, okay, sir, what is it? And he says, I'm not going to embarrass you. I said, okay, sir, what is it? And he goes, well, this folder or this packet tells me that you have a criminal record longer than Figueroa. And that's the longest street in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that downtown, right?
You're physically unfit. Or you're a goddamn queer. And I go, excuse me? And he says, you heard it? Stamped my 4F, gave me the packet, said, turn your two tickets in to the soldier downstairs at the door. And that was it.
That was it.
9:30 that morning, I was at State Beach. And I go, hey, I thought you got drafted. And I said, I was 4F. And they go, 4F? Oh, that's great. And, you know, maybe it was great for some people. I was a little disappointed. And I think that was 1966. A year and a half later, I made the Olympic team.
Yeah, yeah. And is it true that your name on the back of the jersey was 4F?
Whatever. Mm. You know, Rundle would say... we're on the same team. We had two different teams. Anyway, we had all through 68, he goes, maybe, maybe not. Depending on how we play.
Right, right. You know it.
That was indoors. Anyway, let's get on with this thing.
Yeah, so now you got 4F. And then you were playing volleyball at State, but you also had a background in the lumberjack industry and also in the amateur rodeo riding circuit, too, is my understanding. So before we get to the volleyball, did that happen prior to volleyball, and how did that kind of tough guy stuff come about? Volleyball.
Okay, in the little town of Loyal, every little town has got its own little rodeo, amateur rodeo. And, you know, you get caught up in the hoopla of, you know, 4th of July and horses running by and, you know, cowboys look good, the cowgirls look good. You know, if you get drunk enough, probably the cows
even,
start looking
even,
good.
Even the cows and the ponies look good.
And, I just mentioned out loud, how do you get in one of these things? They said, well, you pay $25 and you can ride a bull. And in those days, I was making $1.17 an hour in the lumber mill. So I wasn't a lumberjack in the lumber mill.
Oh, big difference. Got it.
And I said, geez, you know, I just happen to have $20 on me. And I said, I need this, you know, because that $20 is supposed to last for another week and a half. Where I worked, you got paid on the 1st and the 15th of every month, so 4th of July. It was already, you had already had your payday, and you know, I had to make that $20 go through at least the 15th of July.
Yeah.
And they looked around and they said, "Bo, you want to try writing?" And I said, "Yeah." And but I don't have cowboy boots. One guy pulled off his boots and said, "Try these on." And I don't know if they were tight. You know, I didn't have cowboy boots at that time. I just had high top tennis shoes or whatever I was wearing.
Your Chuck Taylors.
Yeah, just no, not quite. Probably Converse.
Yeah.
And you know, the guy says, "Here's $5." I said, "What's the $5 for?" He says, "Well, it's $25, not $20." I said, "But what's the $5 for?" He says, "Insurance. You got to buy insurance before you can ride." I said, "Okay." And so I went there without any knowledge. All the young people in the town of Loyola kind of went, "Oh, is he going to ride?" Now, I don't know if I was left-handed or right-handed, so I rode with my dominant arm, my right hand. And a guy called Hank Castle Jr. Set me down. We called him Pumpkin. And he was in the same rodeo. I think it was his boots that I used, and spurs. And he goes, "Hey, Bo." I go, "What?" "Try spinning." And I couldn't spin. And he said, "You'll be okay." Well, before you sit down on your bull, that thing's moving around the chute, and it's as wide as the chute. And it's going, "Whoa!" You know, it's lowing, and you sit down on it. And I just wanted the experience, that's all. And so he said, I said, "How do you ride these things?" He said, "You put your right foot on the right side and left foot on the left leg on the right leg on the right side, left
almost
leg
like the hokey pokey.
Left side. And keep your mind in the middle." I go, "What?" "Keep your ass in the middle." And I said, "Okay." And so I'm in the chute, I'm all strapped down, and he said, "Hold on to that." He says, "Yeah. Now you can't touch the ball with your free hand." I said, "Nope." And he goes, "Are you ready?" I said, "For what?" You know, and he just said, "I think he's ready. Turn him out." And he, you know, next thing I know, I got some applause from all the locals in town, and I was happy, you know, because I had ridden my bull. I'm walking out of the rodeo, and they say, "Fourth place was Bo May." I go, "What? That's me." So I said, "What did I want?" He said, "You want $157. Now, if you're making $1.17 an hour and you're working 40 hours a week, $157 sounds like a landslide, right? Well, I said, "Where do I get it?" He says, "You got to go to a bar to get it." "You know what?" "You got to go to the bar to get it." I said, "I'm not old enough." So I wasn't old enough to get in the bar. And I said, "But they owe me money. My name's Bo May. You can go check with Ray Hibbs. And if you didn't show up, they didn't give you the money." So he said, "You don't have an idea." I said, "Well, no, I don't." And I had a brilliant thought, which is actually stupid. I said, "I'll buy the house around." They went, "What?" "I'll buy the house around." Well, in those days, their beers were only 25 cents. And you can get a mixed drink for 35.
That works.
I went through $77 right away.
Yeah. But you made a lot of good friends, I bet.
Well, you make good friends waiting for the next round, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also, where'd that guy go again? He went out the back door.
And I said to myself, on the way back to where I was living, "Man, I think I could make a living doing this, you know, if it pays that well." Well, that was only the start of my downfall. The downfall was I was under bulls more than I was on top.
How many seconds did you ride that bull your first time?
8 seconds.
You made it 8 seconds. Oh, yeah. That's the magic number, yeah.
Well, riding the bull is one thing. Getting off is another.
No, yeah, getting that rope off. You know, you're like, Pumpkin didn't tell me this part.
No, he didn't have time to explain. Figuring I'd be off any time, right? And I seemed to follow the circuit around, the amateur circuit, for another year and a half. And The reason why I only went a year and a half is I spent a long time in a cast because a bullet stepped on me in a town, in one of the California towns. And it was bad enough it gave me a contusion, but also pinched my artery. And the doctors didn't know because I was so happy celebrating that I survived that I got busy drinking. Next thing I know, my leg was fat. Everything was fat. And so I took a bus back to San Francisco where my mom was, where my mom and dad had an apartment out in Sunset District in San Francisco.
Okay.
And when I got there, they said, we got to take you to the hospital. When I got there to the hospital, the doctor said, we might have to take your leg off. When did this injury occur? I said, a week ago. And he goes, son, we're going to do our best to save your leg, but that was something very foolish. So I was in the hospital for 3 days, and they had my leg elevated to get the poison or the
infection,
everything into the rest of my body. Because my body was okay, but my leg wasn't. And it was after that, my mom said, no more bull riding. And of course, you always pass that around with yourself. You know, maybe it's, this time I'll be lucky. And like I said, you know, a lot of us drive around, especially in the western states, and you see bulls scrotum under the trailer hitch, right? And the size of the bull sack. Believe me, I've seen them up close and personal.
Quite a visual.
Yeah.
I'm glad I ate dinner already, but keep going.
So that kind of, after that, I stayed away from bull riding. So I went out about 2 years. I had my ropes always, I had my bull rope and my other ropes, thinking I was going to go back. And no, I never went back.
Do you still have them?
I still got my ropes, yeah. And the bull riding thing in my cowbell, I got it packed away somewhere. You know, those are memories that are fleeting.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who's ridden a bull like that and ridden it 8 seconds the first time they did it. So that speaks volumes.
And there's a certain amount of luck. You know, somebody asked me this stupid question. Are you a cowboy? I said, no, I just found this hat. And basically, that's what it is. I just had a cowboy hat on. I went to cowboy. But I still love large animals. I love everything about the rural area. Everything.
Yeah. Yeah, do you still watch it today when you see these guys?
Oh, yeah.
They just blow me away
it.
On these bulls that are scary.
The bulls are the toughest. The Brazilian riders rank, of the five or six riders from Brazil, most of them are in the top 10 or top 15 in the world. You know, that's how good they are. But I was oversized. You know, an oversized, I was really too big.
You were portly?
No, I just, a little too tall. And,
okay.
No knowledge at all.
So you need to be, on the smaller side, almost like a horse jockey, I guess, but somewhere between.
No, you can sit atop the bowl a little bit easier. You get too much weight moving left to right. And if the bull weighs 1,800 pounds, your 160-pound body is pulling against 1,800. 1,800 always wins. You know, it'll pull you over. And bulls are like anything else. They can't wait to get you off so they can stomp the shit out of you. You know what I mean?
Jeez. I couldn't imagine getting stepped on by one and having that happen to you and then having the sack to get back on another one. That's just mind-blowing to me.
Well, you end up doing this. There's a thrill about it that I can still feel when I watch these guys get down in the chute on pro bull riding.
Yeah.
I watch them down in the chute. I've watched bulls with horns reach back while the cowboy is going forward and just shatter their face with their horns. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I've watched people riding, especially new married cowboys, riding with rings on, having the bull rope pulled out from under them and tearing their finger right off their hand. You know, you see injuries that bull riders will get hurt. They always get hurt.
You know, was it that tough Hedeman that rode the bull, was it Yellow Jacket, that reared up and hit him in the face? And he had to have, it was the most amazing, devastating injury I could imagine suffering, to have that bull rear up, hit you square in the face with all that power and skull. And
well, if you look at Tough and you see his face straight on, the doctors put the bone fragments in his face and his upper jaw and his skull back together as best he could, but it's crooked. Look at the before and after, it's crooked.
Yeah,
there's some funny things. And ironically, I almost got a scholarship to rodeo scholarship to BYU, and there's only a few schools giving out scholarships. BYU was one of them. Then when I went down to Fresno State, I wanted to ride bulls down there, and this was after I had recovered. And I said, yeah, I wouldn't mind going through college riding bulls. The reason why I didn't make it at BYU was when I was taking, when I was up there on campus and I was visiting BYU, second time I had been up there, I made the mistake of ordering a Coke with my hamburger. Don't have.
No caffeine, baby.
Well, they knew I wasn't Mormon.
Yeah, and then you asked for a deck of cards and some tobacco and a beer chaser.
No, they said, I don't think we need your kind here.
And then they made the cross sign at you and said, get out.
No, they're very kind of saying that. But, Ernie Sawar and I went up there in 1963. And we went up there as part of a Hollywood YMCA, and we played BYU. At that time, a player, Carl McGon, was a player, not a coach. But they had two other players, John Stanley and John Alstrom.
Two big studs.
And we ended up beating. You know, and Ernie was 19 years old. I was 20.
Talk about a motley crew, Butch.
Yeah, who was to know years later that the four of us would make Olympic teams? Stanley and Alstrom were my teammates, and Ernie Sawar was in 64.
Yeah, so when it came to the volleyball, were you playing in Hawaii? Were you playing...
Over in Hawaii, you could see volleyball going back and forth. I watched volleyball, and but I was walking with my surfboard down Waikiki, and I passed the outrigger. That's when the outrigger used to be next to the Royal Hawaiian, and they had these two courts there, and they were playing outside. And I'm looking, and I said to myself, I want to be just like that guy there. And that guy ended up being Nat Norfleet. Played for, was a member of the Outrigger. He went to Punahou High School, came up and played for Colonel DeGroot. And now, I had to really be young because Nat was my size. Now when I see Nat, or when I see pictures of him, he comes up to my armpit. But they were playing, and they had a couple of guys from the Outrigger. One guy was Tommy Haynes, who'd come over from San Jose State.
Okay.
And he was playing with a guy called, I thought of his name, I was going to write it down. I'll think of it. But they were the best players in Hawaii, next to some Hawaiians that were playing there. Now, the Hawaiians played down at a little court in Waikiki, right near the banyan tree. And one guy's name was Blackout Whaley. Sometimes he played barefoot on asphalt. And he was All-American in the USBBA tournament, Blackout Whaley. And you had different guys down there. Everybody had a nickname, you know, so I didn't know who they were. But the two guys that impressed me at that time was a guy called, and I met him at the Hawaiian Village when I was a junior in high school. And his name was Neil Eldridge, and Gordon Mew. Gordon Mew was about a 6'4 Korean ex-Air Force player, just like Neil Eldridge. And they played doubles at the Hawaiian Village. And the Hawaiian Village had a musician called Arthur Lyman, but a lot of players went there that couldn't get into the operator. And Neil Eldridge was probably as tall as Nat Northley. But he just sat and played defense, and Gordon Mew could pound the ball. And they beat some good players down there. I said, man, I want to play volleyball like that. So when I got to school, I went to all-boys school, St. Louis High School. And they said, hey, Robert, what'd you do this weekend? And when I said I played volleyball, they go, what? That's a girls' game. Anytime somebody asked me, I wouldn't say volleyball as proudly as I do now. I'd say, I was playing volleyball. What? I was playing volleyball. Oh, you play football? Yeah, okay, yeah, touch. I didn't want people to know that I was playing a girls' game. It's not a girls' game, not the way these guys hit. And, so when I got good enough, I snuck into the outrigger. Tommy Haynes was warming up, and he knew I wasn't a member of the outrigger. And he goes, watch out. So I said, hey, how can we play on these courts? And he went up, hit a ball, hit me right in the face.
Yeah. Like Tough Hiedemann, and you look better after.
No, my 2 feet went out from under me, and he says, you're not a member here. And I knew that was Tommy's way of saying, get out. But the best part about it was I made a vow then. I said, I want to be good enough so I can hit him in the face.
You got some grit to you, as Lang would like to say. You didn't lay down and run away like a wuss.
No, so guess what happened? 1968, he's the captain of the Olympic team. And I told Tommy, do you remember hitting this kid? No. He says, a lot of kids tried sneaking in the outrigger. And I told him the story, and he thought I was making it up. But at that time, I was good enough to hit him in the face, and it wasn't worth it. But it gave me some incentive to learn something about the game.
Right, to come back and prove him wrong.
But the guy that taught me the most was and gave me a good start was Neil Eldridge. And then he says, go down to the YMCA, Central YMCA, and practice down there. So I'd go down there. And there was a guy called Wally Wong, who was the best non-outrigger member playing. And he would hit the ball. And he was Chinese, about 6'2". And just great form. And the sound of the ball coming off the wall and the way he hit it. I said, God, I want to play like him. And, all of a sudden... maybe something was telling me that volleyball wasn't that bad. But of course, I come to the mainland. There's no volleyball in Sierra Valley. I missed it until I recovered from my leg injury in the rodeo. I went down to a local YMCA called Embarcadero, and they played volleyball on Tuesdays and Thursday nights. And doing that, we got to watch what they call the Far Western. Far Western tournament had players from Southern California, from Stockton, and as high as Multnomah, this athletic club in Oregon that would come down. And the clubs from Stockton had probably the best players at that time. They had Hollywood YMCA, had players like Mike O'Hara, Barry Brown. There's some good players from a club I never even heard of, Pasadena YMCA. You had Alika Smith. You had Ron Lay. You had Gene Selznick. And all of them with tan bodies. And I said to myself, if they got a tan body, they got to be a good volleyball player. And the Far Western tournament that they had in Northern California at the Naval Air Station in Alameda was would give you the preview of who was going to take first or second in the nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's how good the teams were. And the teams that filtered through, the guys that went to San Jose State, Spike Boris played for Stockton.
Good old Lyle. He's awesome.
Yeah, Lyle Boris.
Didn't they have the Olympic Club there, too, that guys would play on, or did they play for Stockton?
Yes. Well, I met DeGroot over in Hawaii, and the guy that introduced me to DeGroot was Neil Eldridge, because he had just got out of the Air Force. And DeGroot said that if you ever come to the mainland, look me up, you might be a volleyball player. That's all he told me. And so he was coaching at the San Francisco Olympic Club. And at that time, they had a Japanese setter. And the Olympic Club was strictly white. There was no Asians, nothing in it. And it ruffled a lot of members at the Olympic Club. And because of that, DeGroot quit coaching at the Olympic Club and left and went to Southern California. He retired as a Fulbright colonel, and he became a counselor at Santa Monica College. A year later, he brought a college team up. They had players that were John Nobodies, but were all excellent. They ended up beating the top teams in the Far Western.
Wow.
They could all serve. They could all pass. They could all dig. These are names. Some of the players were good beach players. Bob Hogan was a good player. Bob was on that team. You had players that played at clubs like Butch Friedman, Milton Friedman, played at the San Jose Club, an all-Jewish club. It was good. You had Haynes. You had Paul McLaughlin that played at the Outrigger. There's a lot of players that played beach and indoors. And right away I said, that's it. If I ever have a chance to go down to Santa Monica, I'm going to do it. And I ended up doing that.
I heard Hogan and his brother Pete were damn good players. And I always forget whether it was Bob or Pete, but one of them is widely considered to be one of the best diggers that played the game.
Probably Bob.
Yeah.
Probably Bob. I remember coming home and telling Ernie, who was my roommate at Santa Monica College, I said, Ernie, yeah, I just got through beating Hogan. And he goes, Hogan, God, he must have had a good day. I said, oh, God, he's not as tough as they say he was. And he goes, was it Pete? Pete. No, it's not Pete. Was it Bob? Bob? No. I think they called him Joe. Ernie goes, oh, he was the junk one.
Yeah, typical Brooklyn, New York guy, right?
Yeah. So, you see, and then you get to rub shoulders with them,
right?
And then you learn by losing. If you're a good loser, you'll always be a good loser. No, you hide your losses, and you just wait. And wait. But in the meantime, while you're waiting, you work out, you do all the things necessary. You know, Larry Rundle talked about John Adams.
That middle school he was at.
All the volleyball players that were in the South, not South Bay, but in the Santa Monica area, West LA area. Yeah, they were good players there. Everybody played doubles. You know, you come there and, you already knew who was there. Al Skates would show up once in a while. But all the players, and it was important to hold your position because everything was an 11-point game. You know, you played 11, and next, and next thing you know, the lights are out.
Yeah. Rundle told me how imperative Dave Heiser and Don Steer were to him at John Adams Middle School as a kid when you would he would be there, and they helped him out so much and helped him become the player that he became.
Oh, yeah. No, he's just Ernie and I worked at the Santa Monica City College snack bar. And
you ate most of the snacks, though, right?
Well, you know, the guy that owned it was really mean. He said, if you got any leftover hamburgers, throw them up. I don't want to give away any hamburgers. No, and he really felt that way. He worked his way up. And Ernie and I would always make sure, Ernie, did you order that steak sandwich? Oh, yeah. No, they left. Oh, okay. So we can eat. Ernie and I would eat there.
And you hide it under the cash register.
No, we'd always overcook one or two hamburgers. Ernie would have one, I would have one. And that's where our meals were.
Oh, I love the story about you and Ernie living together in that apartment and playing for Colonel Bert DeGroote there at Santa Monica Community College. So you got some good stories about playing for Colonel, and then any fun stuff that happened in that apartment, Butch?
Well, I stayed 3 days with Bert DeGroote, with Colonel. And at that time he says, I'll give you 3 days, and either you can join the service or you're going to have to get a roommate. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And Dave DeGroote was just a little tech. I think he was 10. You had two other DeGroots in the house. Don, his son, who was a good volleyball player, left-handed, and Ned, who was my age. Anyway, he says, I'm going to introduce you to somebody. Maybe you guys get some money together and get an apartment. Well, in those days, you put your down payment and cleanup fees. They didn't have a first and last month. Nobody had money. And so Ernie and I got an apartment for $65 a month, included utilities. And we got it on 4th Street. I think it was 4th Street in Santa Monica, right near Venice. And it was hot, an old stucco apartment. The only breeze that came through was if you left your windows open.
Mm-hmm.
So Ernie and I would do this. We valued eating, but we also valued having a few beers.
That a boy.
And Ernie would come home, and I'd go, or if I came home and we checked the refrigerator, there'd be a couple of beers missing. I said, son of a bitch. Okay. I bought six packs, so three for Ernie, three for me. Well, he gets one more, right? And Ernie probably did the same thing. He probably said, oh, bitch, Butch is drinking two more beers than I am. No, it was the landlord would come down and it'd open up the apartment and drink a beer. And we would save that for the end of the week. Anyway, we asked the guy, have you been drinking our beer? And when there's nothing said, that's probably a complete answer. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I said, Ernie, I'll fix this SOB. He goes, how are we going to do it? Well, we were fishing, and I caught a bonita. And they're a very oily fish. I'm used to eating fish that have whose flesh is a lot harder, and it comes from colder water. Anyway, I took this little bonita. I don't think it must have been 12, 14 inches. Some of it should have been used as bait. And I knew where he lived, so we dug in under the plants. I put this fish. And, at first, no smell the first day. And I said, son, that's the second day. Well, it takes about 3 days before the worms and everything else start going. Well, needless to say, we were already on the way. We were leaving.
he got his payback. He just should have known better.
Well, we like to believe it was. I like to believe it was a payback.
I wonder how long it took him to finally figure out where the hell it was coming from.
Well, you open up the window because it stinks, right? And as long as you see plants there, you're not going to question plants.
Right.
You know? Ernie and I had a good time.
Is it true that Ernie hitchhiked out there from New York to come play there for Colonel Bert DeGroote?
Yeah, Ernie came all the way out to New York to do that, yes.
And he did hitchhike in a garbage bag.
I think he came out with somebody else, so it was easier to do it with two people.
Mm-hmm.
DeGroote would I want you to picture this, like a lantern jaw. And it was his teeth. He had plates up and down. And he'd say, we're going down to the beach, you're going to play volleyball with me today. And I'd look at this 72 or 74-year-old man, I'm going to play with him. And he was testing our volleyball skills. And, you know, so you're going to do it because you're doing it for your coach. And then you realize that it's like swimming with an anchor. You know what I mean?
An albatross.
You know, he had better control. He knew what to do with the ball, whether it was a ball count, it needed to go over. He was deft enough in both hands that he could push it over with the left hand and right hand. And, you know, I'm trying to run in there, trying to set, and the ball is coming out. It was spinning. And he goes, that's definitely a throw. And in those days, there was no bump. Okay, there's no bump, so you either got it with two hands or you put it up with one. And he says, if you're going to try to set me with one, don't take a swing at it. Just let it come off, and I'll get the ball over. Well, we got our asses handed to us. And the group says, you know, you might have the potential to be an okay player. That's all he said. I mean, that was my compliment of the day. And that's where I met Ernie. So Ernie and I got to walk around Santa Monica looking for a place. Now, there was nothing in the immediate area of the school that was in our budget, $65. But the closer we got to Venice, where it started to taper off.
See, with all the shady landlords that love beer.
Well, we didn't, we were happy enough to get a place.
Yeah, at that age, like any college kid that's 19 or 20.
Yep, but playing for the group was, he was a straight shooter, when I say that. He was a psychology major. He was very well, he was knowledgeable in track and field, because that's what he liked to do. And he kept saying track and field's lifetime. And he was in his 90s, still competing track and field, you know. And I used to make fun of him. I said, so Colonel, how far are you dropping the discus? You know, I didn't say throw it. And he says, I'll stick around and wait till you're 90. I want to see how far you throw it. And I never made fun again. But he was a straight shooter when he told you what you should be doing in school, what you shouldn't be doing in school. How to prepare for a sport that you might be playing. In those days, there's no knowledge about weightlifting for specific sports at all. You know, and aerobics weren't even heard of. These were words that were 10, 12 years away from the time I lived.
There's no Von Hagen and Jack LaLanne around.
Jack LaLanne, not LaVon, you know.
Well, I'm from Wisconsin. Come on, Butch, give me a break. I am a loser.
The group said that we're going to try to lift, and he gave us information on lifting that was a little bit different. We did front squats. We did body weights and half your body weight. And if you're strong enough, the group didn't want us to do anything that would injure us. And but the group made sure, okay, that was just part of it. The rest of it was running. He didn't make us run line to line because he did. There was no punishment in his thing. You listen to the skills. We would work on two skills a week, and we'd hit balls the last 6 minutes, and it'd leave out maybe 10 balls. There'd be 12 of us. Trying to hit 10 balls. Well, you hit a ball, you got to go chase it. You want to, and you ran back. But I asked you later on, why did you want us to hit? He says, I didn't want you hitting wrong. And he was correct. He corrected our approach. He corrected the way we set. He corrected the way we passed. He corrected the way we served. And he corrected the way we hit. And he was the first coach I knew of that says you don't have a single hit for every set. So you have to vary the arm swing. whether you use topspin or hitting off of blocks, driving the ball deep, hitting it straight down. Those are all of these things. And, you know, those are some of the things that I try to pass on to the kids that I coach.
And it paid dividends for you when you played on the beach, both in men's opens and with your illustrious mixed open career.
Well, okay, let me make reference to Misty. I wouldn't let Misty make the mistakes that other kids did. I would show her the correct way, and then I'd give her a choice. You can either use that as knowledge, or if you find a better way of doing it, then you do it. And she picked up a lot of things that I suggested. Everything I said was, I suggested that you try it this way or that way. And that's what I do with my kids. But DeGroote was right. If you learn the fundamentals, you can play any game until you're well past 80, any game. And, you know, he was very proficient. He would check out anybody Chinese or coming from Eastern Asia, Vietnam, to see if they played badminton. Why? Because he loved it. DeGroote was Air Force champion, and he just loved the competition. And every time we came into the gym, it was coach's time in the gym, he was always playing badminton. So he understood the angles on the court, the high clears, the drop shots, doing all of those things.
Sure.
Kind of transitioned over into what he coached.
You know, when I interviewed Skates, he holds Colonel Burt DeGroote in the highest regard because he lost to him a lot early on when he was at UCLA and started his own team. And I think that speaks volumes about what he did with his coaching there with you guys there early on. And then he recruited his players to come play for him.
Well, Ernest Awaram was the first to get a scholarship at UCLA, and full scholarship, full ride. And Skate says, "Butch, if you get your grades up, I give you a scholarship." I said, "If I get my grades up, I want to play football." He goes, "Then you're not coming to UCLA." It's okay. Now, what DeGroote had done was he took a junior college and he took players that would accept his type of coaching. At that time, everything was a 4-2. The guy that introduced 5-1 or 6-0 to Southern California was Gene Selzer. And he brought that back from Europe. He says, this is the future of our game.
Yep.
Nobody believed him.
He was ahead of his time. Too bad Harry Wilson didn't listen.
But he was also his worst enemy. You know, he ruffled feathers, whether it was from the executive committee of the USCBA or the head of volleyball. You know, that's what he did. Because Selznick said we should change. Selznick had a more exciting way to play the game. We're talking about indoors. And, you know, all the group told us in 1963, if we learn all the skills, which is serving, passing, setting, hitting, blocking, digging was like passing, okay. We had no bump at that time, so we'd have to be good enough to get in there with our hands. Everybody was. Lang, all the guys that passed the ball for Mike O'Hara when he played at Hollywood YMCA. Because Mike would throw the ball. Can you imagine you're serving and there's five guys in front of you raising their hand and they're shaking their hands and you serve right over that the screen. You call it a screen. And on contact, if you were to get the ball and you had bad hands, five of the players on your side would all clap their hands at the same time to muffle the sound of a throw. It was, but you had skilled players like Selznick, Lang.
Bernie Holtzman, I heard, was amazing at it.
Rolf Engen was a magician with his hands. There's a couple of guys. We left out a couple of brothers that played volleyball. And Randy and Scott.
Oh, the Carters.
Yeah, the Carters. They're both good. Both excellent. You know, but the skilled players always had a spot on the team, you know, indoors. And, of course, the skilled players always had a partner for the beach. You could serve anything. Topspin serve, roundhouse. And nobody had a jump serve. Of course, Vogie says he invented the jump serve.
Well, he also invented the toaster, the microwave, and the space shuttle.
Vogie's had so many patents that were taken away from him.
Yeah. Well, he invented the internet, too, but I forgot about that.
You know, the skilled players always had a place on the court. And that's because that's the way volleyball was. Not saying that the southern part of California, San Diego Downs, San Diego County, San Diego had a lot of good volleyball players. Because they played both. They played indoors and outdoors.
Yeah, any particular names you want to mention?
Oh, the Goss brothers. Jack Hinn was good. There's a
Chester
lot
and Stevie?
Yeah. Yeah, and, they, and then you had the tournament director. He was good.
George
you
know, Stepanoff, legend. Yeah, Stepanoff nicest guy ever who's done more for the sport than he ever were. Could be given enough credit for.
Yeah, we could run through. And the players were equally as skilled as you went north, but they played with teams that that couldn't fill the spots that were necessary. In other words, they just had players. They had one or two skilled players. Wink Davenport played for a YMCA back east. He was the only player that was had hitting skills, and he could block. You know, passing skills, digging probably not, but he could block. There's just you could go down the list.
Does the name Nate Parrish ring a bell for you from San Diego?
Yeah, he was crazy. Crazy Nate. He was good. Oh, there's some characters that played this game. You had players that were indoors. I can't think of his name. Pete. I'll think of it. Anyway, he just talked your head off. But Butch Friedman was good. Very smooth in his movements. But he would put balls down after ball, get off your hands, you drive you nuts. You had two brothers that played for UCLA, Eddie and his brother, who's a doctor. You know, the beach.
Was it Machado?
Machado, no. Eddie, I can't think of his name.
What about Bill Olson? I heard he could lay the wood to the ball. Does that name ring a bell?
Bill who?
Bill Olson.
Oh, yeah. Big Bill, yeah. Olson.
He was a pitcher in the major leagues, and he just had an arm that was scary, and he'd hit over
the
ball.
He had an arm that was straight, his hand went right behind his back, like he was touching the nape, and just took a swing. Yeah, Olson was a good player. They had jumpers there. Barry Brown was a good player. There was the players that went in 1964.
For the Olympics, when Harry picked and chose the team according to politics?
Yeah, well, Harry was one-sided. He said, you play for me, you make the Olympic team.
Chuck Nelson.
He was trying to be fair. No, he wasn't fair. he already had his team picked.
Like Skates got left off that team. A bunch of really good players. Bill Grebenow and
Bill Grebenow went in 64.
Oh, okay, my mistake.
Bill Grebenow was from Santa Monica College, and that was DeGroote's best setter for indoors at that time. Well, he was a good setter, but you had players that complemented everything that DeGroote had put together, because everybody could pass, everybody could dig, and their one-arm control was awesome. Let me let me tell you what happened in 1964. We had an exhibition with the Olympic team, the chosen ones, against the other 12. And we had it at Cerritos College.
Okay.
So we were playing the Olympic team exhibition. And Harry had mentioned something. If players are good enough to take our players' place, they deserve to be on the Olympic team. Well, in a 5-game set, the Olympic team didn't garnish enough points to win one 15-point game. So all the alternates, and as part of the alternates, we beat the hell out of the Olympic team.
And who was on the alternates with you?
Southern was the center. They had Bob Hogan, Skates was playing, Rudy Sawara, Jack Hamm, myself, Dennis Dugan.
The Condor with his, 38-inch sleeves.
That's when Selda started to mock the United States team. But volleyball was just being presented as an introduction sport by the Japanese. And the skills that they took back to the Olympics were archaic. So we were still playing 1962-1963 volleyball, and they were playing 1964 volleyball. The world had already passed us. So we ended up, we can always say we tied for ninth. Well, there's only 10 teams.
Well, yeah, because the U.S. team went there passing overhand, and they got called on the first first play. It was bullshit.
It was bullshit. We never paid attention.
Well, because I hit Wilson, it was bullshit. And I know
we were so enamored with our own stuff. We invented the game. If the rules had changed, we were going to convince the International Olympic Committee that we had invented it and that they would adhere to what we had to say. Not even close.
Nope.
107 countries went one way. We ruined Japan and Mexico because we told them to play like us. I remember that. I did Cerritos College. And Harry says, this should not be published. It's only an exhibition game. And he says, and from now on, no of the alternates are going to practice. So that was it. And we knew that, Ernie, Erickson, all of those guys had 26 days and they would all be back. And they came back. First thing Selznick did, he phoned Harry Wilson and just berated him. And
good
it was something that should never have been done. Harry, I can see Harry still shaking today. Harry would have been a better man to hang up than to take that.
Yeah.
And Selznick did that from State Beach.
And I heard the group of the guys went before a board to complain about the players that were left off in honor of some of the other people, because half the team hated the other half of the team because they made it because of politics.
Well, let's just say the team that was taken wasn't the best team.
Nope.
There were players, but that's what happens when you're trying out for the Olympics.
To this day, it makes me sad because I know that Olympics meant everything to Lang, and they went in there without their best team, and they had a coach that Ingen was not on the team, and he used to line the team up. And then Lang told me that Wilson said, "All right, Lang, you line them up." He goes, "Nope, I'm the player, you're the coach, you line them up," because he was so disgruntled with who he chose to be on the team.
Well, like I said, we when the alternates, when all of us got together and we played them at Cerritos College, the audience was Look, you had guys like Erickson and Ernie hitting the hell out of the ball, right? You had Pete Filescu on that team. Pete Filescu made two teams. It's just the team was fractured in such a way that there wasn't a good cohesive group. Not saying that O'Hara couldn't put a ball down, but when you have an Olympic team and you play three games and you don't make enough points to win one game, something's wrong. But that was it. We knew that we'd have to wait another 4 years.
And they learned a lot from that then after that, not to wait like a couple months before the Olympics to put everyone together and train when the other players and other teams in the world were playing together for a year or two plus longer.
Well, that's what made the USSR so strong. You got 17 countries there, right? I mean, now there's 17. But they got them from all over. They got the best players. Yeah, they're big and strong and burly, very lithe. They were soft in their movements and very strong in their hitting.
Did you ever see Boogie Yankov?
Oh, yeah.
Skate said he was one of the best hitters he ever saw.
Well, at that time. Yes. There's good players today that are just awesome. You know, but he would start off left front and hit a slide. Right side, come all the way across, hit a slide, and nobody knew where this player was going. Hey, left, right. If you were lined up on him, you'd go, "Hey, where'd he go?" That was it. Yeah, kaboom. But Ernie, Ernie went with a national team and went across the provinces of Canada, and the Russians said that Ernie going across could have been a player that could play for any country, power country. And you had countries like Czechoslovakia was good, Romania was good, East Germany was good, Russia was good. Ernie could have played for them. That's how well Ernie played. His hitting, anyway.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about this because everyone I've talked to, specifically Skates, he coached UCLA for 50 years when it was an NCAA sport, and for a handful of years when it was a USVBA sport before 1970 in the 60s. And he said of all the players he ever had there, nobody hit the ball harder than Ernie Sawora. So I'm sure you've seen some of his big bangs. Do you have a specific one in memory you want to share with us?
Well, the first day of scrimmage at Santa Monica College, all the sophomores were going, "Do you know that you guys won't be playing? Because coach only takes the experienced players first, and then everybody after that." Well, we had two kids right out of high school, Phil Lingman and Bob Conrad.
Okay. Is he related to Edie Conrad?
That's Edie's son. Okay. Yes. And we had six on one side, six on the other, started serving. And it only went, I think, 3 or 4 points. And almost went to complete rotation for us, the freshmen coming in. Now we had center, Art Grossman, who played for Westside Community Center. He's 42 years old, and he came in there. Phil Lingman was a center, and Bob Conrad was outside hitter. Bill Clemmel was a center, opposite. Ernie Sawora and I both played the left side. Well, you hit all the way around. And who else was on that? Jim Graham. Fontanella, I mean, I could...
Is that classic photo I stole from Bill Clemmel that has you guys all together? And
there's two guys missed. Bob Conrad and Phil Lingman were missing from that photo.
Okay.
Okay, now, we get up there, and everybody's waiting to play because the group, what he says goes. And I got the hit, I hit a cross-court shot, and then the ball was being spread around so that everybody could hit. Ernie got a set a little bit inside on the left side, and his son Ned was playing the left side, dropped off with his hands up, and Ernie hit the ball so hard hurt his glass. It looked like a vampire to the top of his nose. He had the it just shattered everything, and all the groups and practices on. We know
he devastated the dude trying to dig angle against him on the other side of the court.
It was inside.
He got tough heat him in.
No, they had it was a 7-foot line then, and he hit it inside. He didn't have time to yell "screw communism." You know what I mean? Just that thing went boom, and we all went ooh. Yeah. And the Grusin practice was over. We're done. And then there was another time we're playing at Santa Monica College, and we had a tournament there. And there's a guy called Horace something. I forgot what his last name was. A black guy. And Ernie goes up, and he goes to hit a ball, and the Horace is right in there with his hands up, hits right off his hands, and it goes back over the net. Setting for Cairo radio station was a childhood actor. That was Tony Dow.
Oh, yeah, from my favorite TV show as a kid, Leave It to Beaver. And he was a volleyball player.
So the ball goes back over, and I'm going to get the next set because Phil's just eating up the. Or he says, give it to me. Boom. Next time. As he's coming in, the hands, the ball had already hit him in the chest. It was on the back part of his hands by the time he closed his hands. I mean, Ernie had hit the ball, and before he could close his hands, it had gone off his chest.
He has a heart murmur to this day, I heard.
Oh, no, no. It was one of those things. And he goes, what the hell was that?
Gee whiz, Beef.
That's what Ernie did. Yeah. We can always rely on Red. If you needed some help, give it to Red. But then we got carried away. Because Ernie and I played on the beach more than anybody else. If I call for the ball to set the second ball, I give it to Ernie. Ernie called the setter off. He gave it to me. And the crew says, we're not playing doubles. We're not playing doubles. Now, I mentioned something about UCLA. UCLA lost to Santa Monica College. That was us, 1964, at the Air Force Academy.
Okay.
And because of that, they had to have a separate champion in the college division.
Okay.
And that was the base. And that was they laid out plans for the NC2A at that time, where two-year colleges were excluded because they didn't want the I shouldn't say embarrassment. It is an embarrassment to have a two-year college, a four-year school. Now this is who we beat at
Air Force. Okay.
Yeah, you had Ohio State, you had BYU, San Diego State, UCLA. You had other colleges there, and they're all trying to compete, and we just happened to be right in the middle of this, doing that. And we ended up playing UCLA, and we devastated UCLA.
Yeah, what I love about Skates is he'll give credit where credit is due. And that, like you, when you got hit in the face by Tommy Hain and all the other things that happened to you, where you go, okay, I'm going to work harder, get better, work out, and I'm going to come back and whoop your ass. So,
often. Well, I didn't whoop your ass. I just want to hit him in the face with the ball.
Same difference. And by the way, when you beat BYU, did you open up a can of Coke and cheer him?
No. Actually, you know, the group would give us traveling money. Now, as a team, he wanted you to look like a gentleman, so you needed a haircut.
Well, that was a big stretch for you.
Well, that haircuts cost almost $2. And, you know, we didn't have the
2 money. 2 weeks so in the lumber mill.
No. That's a couple of weeks. Anyway, we went over to Jim Graham's house. Jim Graham had invited Ernie and I over for dinner. And we ate all his food. So normally Jim's wife would cook, and they would have leftovers for a couple of days. You know what I mean? Like most families. Ernie and I took an appetite, and we ate everything. And it was Jim's birthday, I think, or a near celebration. And then we asked Jimmy, "Hey Jimmy, could you cut our hair?" And he goes, "Sure." Well, you know, when you're not fixed to doing it right, sloping things and edging right, you take a little bit more off than you think, and it's really ending up a bowl cut, you know what I mean? It's going higher and higher. So finally I just said, "Well, just give us a buzz." In other words, you took everything off.
So high and tight.
We're going up to BYU to play BYU, representing Hollywood YMCA. And we are completely unadorned. We look like the group, completely bald.
Without the teeth.
Without the teeth. And we get up there, we got our hats on, and we're warming up at the Y in their old field house, which is the biggest thing I've ever been in. And we're warming up, and the group says, "Gentlemen, take off those silly hats." And so we said, "Coach, can we play with them on?" He says, "Not on my team." So as soon as Ernie and I reached up and we pulled them off, all he said was, "Oh my God."
Put the hats back on in a stocking.
Well, at that time, nobody had a haircut like that. Not even in the service. They gave you a little bit of a buzz, but not that much.
Not even Bill Leica?
Not even Bill Leica. So later on, when we played the Y again, in downtown Salt Lake City, the car goes by and he goes, "Hey, Baldies!" And the girl turns to Ernie and I, and they're talking about you two. He said, "No, we got our hats on." They were talking about him. Ernie and I always laughed about that. So, yeah, that's
good times in life, Butch.
Yeah, we did. We did. We just made lots of friends. We already knew that Ernie was special.
Not short bus special like me and Bogey, but the real kind of special.
No, he's a real thing. You know, he just. I'd seen him play a year before I met him, or a couple of years before I met him, in San Antonio. And the first time I saw him hit a ball, he just drilled the ball. He was playing with New York, or Westside at YMCA out in New York. And the next thing I know, he's hitting left-handed. I go, "Jesus, that guy can hit the ball." And then he hits again, and I go, "My God, I thought he had red hair. He's got dark hair." Was the three tomorrow brothers. He had John, Rudy, and Ernie. Ernie had let it off. He was the first to hit. And then John, the left-handed, hit. And then Rudy hit. And here, all the time, I was thinking, "God, am I seeing that?"
Whatever. You're chasing triple.
Yeah.
Not the good kind.
No, it was good.
Von Hagen told me the first time he went to Nationals, he was warned by people there to watch out for the New York team because the Sawara brothers would aim for the opposing hitting line and that they could hit the shit out of the ball. And he goes, "They were right."
They're right. Ernie had a good jump. They all did. Had George Fetz, who was a barrel-chested guy. He looked like the Russian that played outside hitters for his name is B.L. And in 68, he's barrel chested, and every time he hit the ball, the crowd would go, "Oh."
Just like Henry Bergman back in the day.
Better, harder Bergman. Bergman hit the ball hard, but not as hard as these guys. Ernie could hit the ball.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Lang and Von Hagen have been on me to get an interview with him, but he just like every girl I ever called back in high school and college, he doesn't take my call. He's always out of the country or washing his hair.
Yeah. No, it's just what a great start, you know, for me.
So yeah, I mean, to learn from the colonel and get all the fundamentals down, and then goes on to your beach career. So we'll cut it off here, Butch.
I got one more thing about the colonel. Colonel called us in. We were playing in a tournament at UCLA. We're supposed to play a double final with UCLA, but it was UCLA's tournament. Al called the tournament off, and UCLA won. And at that time, we had bad news. Colonel says, then you guys aren't going to the Air Force Academy. What? It's up to the school to send you to the Air Force Academy. And we went, holy crap. Man, we screwed up. Because we were kind of messing around. We knew we could beat UCLA. Anyway, it was our fault. Well, Good comes in, and he says, I want to talk to each one of you for 4 minutes. I just want 4 minutes of your time, and you go on. Well, he met with each one of the players, and holy crap! What's he gonna say, Butch? You said early too much. You're not doing enough of this. So, you know, you think. So Butch, he said the same thing to everybody. The best player on our team says. You may, and he said this to the practice players also. He said, you're the best player on the team. If it wasn't for you, these guys wouldn't be there. You're the one that made these guys. Well, he said that to the starting team. You know, if it wasn't for you, these guys wouldn't be making it, because now you're doing your best to make them better. Anyway, he said, you're the most important player on our team. So after we won the national, we're all drinking at the NCO club. There's only, I think, three of us that were old enough to have beers. But everybody was drinking.
Getting lit up like a Christmas tree?
Yeah, well, we had a round table full of beer bottles. And there was some dead air. And nobody knew what to say. And we all said it almost at the same time. Hey, I met with the group. You know, so there's like an echo, a cappella. I met with the group. We all said, yeah. And you know what the group told me? Now we're saying this verbatim. And you know what the group told me? That I was the best player.
Even the water boy kind of chimed in.
Well, it goes to show he was a psych major, right?
Yeah. He had it all under his thumb.
And he knew what to do to keep your attention. Oh. And that was it. And, you know, I told him before he died. There's a lot of people that we can love, and we share that today. You know, with the players that we see, players that we've had arguments or some of the best challenges against, not counting the wins or even worrying about the losses. We can look at each other and say, man, I love you.
Yeah, all those amazing stories, war stories, battling competitors, and then buddies. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Well, you nailed it tonight, Butch. Like, we only made it through like three questions, which I figured it would go that way, and it's epic, and it's so good that I'm so amped up. I think I'm going to try to make this into a podcast tonight and post it.
Hey, I'll talk to you later.
This concludes part one of our interview with Butch. Appreciate you listening. As a reminder, we have a website, which is godstoghosts.com, that you can visit, which pays tribute to commemorating the history of this amazing sport. And finally, I want to give credit to the musicians that we use for our podcast. The opening track is from the band Sponge. The song title is Rainin', and it's off the album Rotting Pinata. The closing track, which you'll hear momentarily, comes from the band Magna Carta Cartel. Track title is That It's Already Too Late, and it's off the album Good Morning Restrained. Thanks for listening.
Okay.